in hearing these words. You don't have to get it or try to figure it out or track it. Just allowing the words, these words that point to wise view and offer perspective of wisdom, just letting them land simply gently. And opening to the effect that they have on your present moment experience. Some words might have a very deep resonance, and some not at all, depending on your own path, how your own mind is oriented in this moment. The more settled the mind is, at least in my own exploration and understanding and massaging these words in my own practice, as the mind is more settled, the words can bring in new understandings, new resonances, and open the mind maybe to just a hint of something. Like the Buddha speaking to us from 2,600 years ago and transmitting his mind to us. So today I'd like to reflect on a sutta that's another, could say, elaboration of the Bahiya Sutta. So going back over terrain we've already explored. So but with some new words. The sutta today is called the Kalakarama Sutta. I'll post the reference. And in this sutta, actually, in this talk today, I'm only going to pull out a couple of paragraphs. So not even trying to go through the whole thing, just a little bit of it. Hopefully, in my own, how I am in retreat, you know, it's easier to take in little bits when my mind is still like this. So just offering a little bit here. So the section to reflect on that I'd like to reflect on is a part where the Buddha describes essentially his own experience, the experience of the mind of awakening. So maybe this can be a little bit of an inspiration for us, a little sense of possibility. The Buddha didn't describe his own experience that often. And so this is a beautiful, a beautiful reflection. And it, in a way, kind of expands on what the Buddha said to Bahiya. The Buddha said, one should train oneself. And the seen is only the seen, and the heard is only the heard, and the sensed is only the sensed, and the cognized is only the cognized. And then he went on to say, when for you that is the case, when for you in the seen is only the seen, and the heard is only the heard, and the sensed is only the sensed, and the cognized is only the cognized, that is freedom, essentially. And so this passage is a little bit of an elaboration on what it means, perhaps, for the mind to be in that space. So I'll read this. I'll read a couple of paragraphs, and much as in the Bahiya Sutta, it's repeated for seen, heard, sensed, cognized. The first paragraph is, or that we're bringing, I'll bring in today. Whatsoever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, sought after, and pondered over by the mind, that I have fully understood. All that is fully known to the Tathagata, his name for his way of expressing himself. One thus gone, or one such, the such-like one. All that is fully known to the Tathagata, but the Tathagata has not taken a stand on it. Even just that, for me, has a little bit of a kind of a flavor of not taking a stand on what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized. No ground, nowhere to land, just experience passing through in the moment, not taking a stand on it. I'll reflect more on that word probably in a couple days, on that piece of this in a couple days. And the piece I'd more like to explore now is the next section. The Tathagata does not conceive of a visible thing apart from sight, does not conceive of an unseen, does not conceive of a thing worth seeing, does not conceive of a seer. The Tathagata does not conceive of an audible thing apart from hearing, does not conceive of an unheard, does not conceive of a thing worth hearing, does not conceive of one who hears. Tathagata does not conceive of a thing to be sensed apart from sensation, does not conceive of an unsensed, does not conceive of a thing worth sensing, does not conceive of a sensor, one who senses. Tathagata does not conceive of a cognizable thing apart from cognition, does not conceive of an uncognized, does not conceive of a thing worth cognizing, does not conceive of a cognizer. So maybe some of those words have some resonance, some sense or hint maybe of what it might mean to be in a mind experiencing in that way. And maybe some of it doesn't make any sense at all. So a few reflections on this. Certainly not fully formed, but some reflections that have supported for me a little more connection, or maybe touching into just a hint of what that freedom might be. So one word that's used here is conceiving. The Tathagata does not conceive. Conceiving this word is connected with conceit, connected with the sense of I am. And so every conceiving in here is already pointing to this dichotomy. The springing up, as we talked about with the conversation around Papancha, the springing up of a thing and one who knows that thing kind of coming up together. This is the process of conceiving. Perhaps the word is very in the commentaries, it connects this word conceiving very much to the word papancha we talked about the other day. Maybe the papancha side is more kind of focused on the objectification, the reification of a thing, and the conceiving side is more pointing to the I am side of the process at work. So the suttas describe our usual, an ordinary person's usual relationship to experience from another perspective than Mahakachana offered in the Honeyball Sutta that we talked about the other day. So in another discourse, there's a description of an ordinary person relating to experience. And it begins sounding pretty good. It starts, one perceives the scene as the scene. Sounds kind of like the Bihiya Sutta. One perceives the scene as the scene. In the scene is only the scene. And yet there is the one in the sentence here. So perhaps already some distortion in the perception. One perceives the scene as the scene. Having perceived the scene as the scene, one conceives oneself as the scene. One conceives oneself in the scene. One conceives oneself apart from the scene. One conceives the scene to be mine, and one delights in the scene. Why is that? Because it has not been fully understood. So this points again to the conceiving, the I am process, but it's pointing to some different relationships, different ways that the I am kind of is in relationship to the world. I am the scene. One conceives oneself as the scene. I am the scene. Maybe, you know, that might not make too much sense, but remembering that this is repeated for all seen, heard, sensed, cognized. And so maybe one conceives oneself as the cognized. One conceives oneself as the anger. One conceives oneself as the doer, the intender. One conceives oneself as the cognized. One conceives oneself in the cognized. And again, for sense experience, that might or might not make a lot of sense. But perhaps for the body, the sensing of the body, conceiving oneself to be in the body somehow. An I kind of being carried around by this body, a sense of me carried around by the body, inside the body. One conceives oneself apart from the seen, heard, sensed, cognized. Apart from that sense of me and that. I and that. Whether that is another person, me and them, or that is an object, a sense of other than thatness. This to me is very familiar, this experience. That feels like it describes a lot of my experience, sense of self, other than that. Conceiving myself other than that. That seems to be the way my mind goes around defining experience. Yep, I'm not that, I'm not that, I'm not that. I'm defining myself in the negation. Others may define themselves more in the, yep, that's me, that's me, that's me. So again, different flavors, different minds. Different proclivities, different habits, different conditioning, different shaping. You know, it's kind of like I walk around, it's like at a really subtle level. I mean, just looking out at this room, it's kind of like the sense or the experience is almost like, yep, I'm not the chair. I'm not the wall. I'm not the air. I don't know exactly what I am. I just know what I'm not. That kind of I in relationship somehow, that I springing up in relationship to experience. The next one, one conceives the seen to be mine, the seen, heard, sensed, cognized to be mine. This one's also very, very familiar to me. What's mine, what's not mine? It's kind of the both of those. You know, it's either mine or it's not mine. And it's you know, not only objects, but it's like my my mind. Like there's some I here that owns these aggregates. An I here that is like in charge, ruling them. And boy, the teaching on the uncontrollability of the aggregates really helps to undermine that one. So this reflection begins to point to ways that we don't, the ways that our mind conceives is ways in which it is not simply in the seen is only the seen, and the heard is only the heard, and the sensed is only the sensed, and the cognized is only the cognized. Conceiving the kind of the peace or the springing up of conceiving separates us, separates the mind from that simple awareness, simple knowing. And the seen is only the seen. So the back to the words the Buddha used to describe his own experience. The Tathagata does not conceive of a visible thing apart from sight. This one, flipping it around, how we might, in fact, conceive of a visible thing apart from sight might help us to understand that process. So much of the Buddha's teachings on freedom talk about the absence of some process or some, usually processes, the absence of craving, the absence of greed, the absence of aversion, the absence of delusion. That's freedom. The absence of conceiving freedom. And so even his description of his own experience is used in terms of the absence. The absence. He doesn't describe, yes, it is like spacious and low, you know, just vast. And he says it's absent conceiving. All these different ways of conceiving. Think about that one. That one too. Absent of that one too. So his experience of this freedom is described as absent of conceiving here. And so the study or the exploration might be to get to know the conceiving really well, to get to know when that's happening, how it functions. And so here, if we flip all four of these around, we might begin to see, or the mind might begin to recognize ways in which it's doing this conceiving process that it hadn't been aware of. This is not something to do. To me, this reflection, sometimes it can, even just reflecting on this, these words, on the language, so this is using Chintamaya Panya. This is using that reflective wisdom. And sometimes using that reflective wisdom can create an opening for the mind to just touch something, maybe taste the absence of something, or maybe get more familiar with the presence of something. It was like, whoa, I hadn't seen that happening. So, the Tathagata does not conceive of a visible thing as apart from sight. This reflects back on what I feel like we've been exploring from the beginning of the retreat. The lust is a something. Lust is a maker of things. Lust, greed, aversion, delusion, a something. Making a package out of experience, and yep, that's a thing. That's that thing making. And so here the Buddha says, one does not conceive of a visible thing as separate from the seeing process. This is the kind of the reification of the idea, the thing making of it, the believing that the experience is somehow a thing apart from the seeing, somehow a separate thing. And as I said the other day, it's my understanding that that the experience, and the Buddha is speaking of experience here, the experience is a reflection perhaps of something that's out there. You know, in all likelihood, I think there's stuff out there, and that the mind does a pretty good job. I mean, either the mind does a pretty good job of it, or you know, somehow this mind has made up a whole like community of people that's all agreeing that things are going this way and that way. But somehow that is always, you know, messing up too. You know, that image of this mind just making up the whole world. You know, I suppose it's possible. I can't say it's not possible, but the sense of like how much there is happening, like the creation of automobiles, you know, like as far as I know, my mind had nothing to do with that. And yet the mind creates the idea of automobile, and that's what I experience. So the kind of the conceiving is this creation of the sight and the idea that there is a thing that is separate from the seeing. So the experience here is pointing to there's the seeing is what is happening. The seeing is what is happening. And that is the experience. Nothing else. And kind of resonating with that such word that I brought in the other day. Nothing other than that. Nothing other than seeing happening. And the idea perhaps that we think we need to, that somehow we need to have the thing other than seeing in order to navigate the world, that's just the view of greed, aversion, and delusion. That's just the view that somehow there needs to be that thing in order to navigate the world. The Buddha here describes an example of someone who experiences the world without that conceiving of a visible thing as apart from sight, and still can navigate the world, still can see things, still can walk around, still can talk to people, still can engage, but not misunderstand. Another translation for the sutta, I'm using the translation here. This translation is very resonant for me, which is why I'm offering it. The translation I'm offering is from Jnanananda. Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation goes something like, Having seen what can be seen, the Tathagata does not misconceive the seen. So does not misunderstand that the idea that there is something seen, a thing seen, just in the seen. In the seen is only the seen. So we tend to conceive of a visible thing as apart from sight. But what might it mean? Just not conceive of a visible thing apart from sight, an audible thing apart from sound, a thing to be sensed apart from sensation, a thing to cognize apart from cognition happening. Perhaps supporting the mind to recognize what the mind is experiencing is constructed by the mind. The next one. The Tathagata does not conceive of an unseen. Now this one, I don't know what this means. Various commentaries, things that I've read about this, they offer different perspectives. The commentaries, oh, I don't have the book right here. That's too bad. I can't read it to you. The commentaries say something like, the Buddha does not imagine that he's seeing something that the rest of the people do not see. That's a little hard for me to understand, except maybe, you know, maybe that's, it's kind of like, not conceiving of there was some way it made sense to me at one point as that landed, but it's gone now. I can't get there again. So that one, I don't know. That's one commentary that says something like that. But, you know, maybe again, I reflected on this a little bit. There's two ways that for me this resonates, or two ways that for me this kind of speaks to something that seems interesting to reflect on. So if we think about, so the Tathagata does not conceive of an unseen. So habitually we might conceive of an unseen. So what might that mean, that we conceive of something unseen? This could mean that we're conceiving of something happening outside of our range of vision. You know, an imagining of something going on and having responses and reactions around it. I had this experience at one point when I was in relationship before my practice began. I actually saw this process and kind of laughed at it even before I was meditating or before I knew what meditation was. But I saw at one point my mind kind of create this idea of what my partner might be doing. And then I got mad about it. There was, you know, it was completely constructed in the mind. There was nothing seen, but there was this unseen, this, you know, this idea that might be happening. And then the mind got like all torn out of shape around it. And then I noticed, wow, I just completely made that up. I have no idea what my partner is doing. No idea. So I don't know. That could be something related to it. Also, potentially, you know, it's like what might it mean for the ordinary person to create a sense of separation around something not seen? Maybe there's an idea. Here's one that just popped into my mind. The idea of Nibbana. Let's take Nibbana. People, teachers, the Buddha talking about Nibbana, and, you know, perhaps unseen by that kind of experience, not touched into, and creating a sense of separation. I haven't experienced that. That's a problem. You know, so that it's a connection with something unseen. So we don't have to just separate from things that are actually, you know, that are seen, heard, sensed, cognized. The mind can create an idea of something that it doesn't understand, for instance. That's the one that kind of resonates the most for me in this moment. I've seen in my own experience the mind wanting to have an insight, having heard descriptions of insight in Dharma talks, wanting that, wanting the unseen, wanting what I don't know, creating a sense of self around that thing not known or not understood. I don't know, that could be what this is connected to. It does feel kind of relevant. There's certainly suffering around that. I've seen suffering around that. I actually saw at one point the mind suffering so much over that wanting to have that insight. But then what I saw, I mentioned this in a group, I think, this morning. Then what I saw was the mind telling my teacher that I had seen that thing. That was kind of in the mix when I was wanting or having that, you know, deep urge or that wish, that longing to have that insight happen. And what I discovered actually in that moment was that what I wanted was not really the insight, but to be seen as having had the insight. To be seen as having seen it or understood it. So that's perhaps another one I thought of. Actually, I thought of it earlier. It was in my notes and I'd forgotten about it. An idea perhaps around something that is unseen and a view kind of like, well, if I can't see that, or if I can't experience that, it means it doesn't exist. So that could be a relationship that comes up with the unseen. So somebody might, in the, you know, hearing about the Buddha saying, yes, possible to experience things in the seen is only the seen and the heard is only the heard. Possible to experience the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion. And somebody else saying, well, I haven't experienced that, so not possible. That could be another form of this relationship to the unseen, a denial of the possibility of its existence, of its possible existence, of its possible unfolding. Let's leave the word existence out of things. Another idea that has occurred to me about this particular reflection does not conceive of an unseen is kind of what I spoke to earlier. I said, you know, I actually think there are things out there. You know, the mind, I see that what is arising, all that I experience, at times it seems very clear and kind of awesome that there's this understanding, there's an understanding that the entire world that is being seen, the entire world of experience is constructed by the mind. And so that kind of recognition might lead to a sense or to an idea that if the only experience that's happening, the only experience that is this being touches is what is constructed by the mind, then the mind might reify the idea of there's nothing out there. That it is all mind. So perhaps sitting somewhere in the middle, recognizing the experience is constructed by the mind. As I said, I believe there's something out there. I don't really know, but I believe there is something out there. Maybe holding this something in the middle, neither something existing nor something non-existing. The difference between that place that the Buddha talked about, we are caught in that. It either exists or it doesn't exist. So the Tathagata does not conceive of an unseen, does not conceive of an unheard, does not conceive of an unsensed. Does not conceive of an uncognized. Does not conceive of a thing worth seeing, a thing worth hearing, a thing worth sensing, a thing worth cognizing. This to me brings in the really clear notion of craving, of the something worth seeing because the mind, the greed, the aversion, the delusion, think it's worth landing on. Thing worth the thing worth kind of being with, that kind of the thing worth seeing is a thing that the mind might conceive of as reliable. And so this kind of conceiving undermined through seeing the impermanent nature of experience. Seeing the not conceiving of a visible thing apart from sight. No thing worth seeing, not conceiving of a thing worth seeing. And the last one is not conceive of a seer, one who sees, one who hears, one who senses, one who cognizes. The basic conceiving. Does not conceive of a conceiver. Does not conceive of a perceiver. Of a feeler. This one may touch into the deeper way in which the sense of the conceiving happens. There's another phrase that the Buddha points to around the sense of self. He repeatedly, many, many places, says one should reflect, using it as reflection. Often he's encouraging this kind of Chintamaya Panya, the reflective wisdom. One should reflect. This is not mine. This is not who I am. This is not myself. These three different frames, or three different ways, perhaps different ways of a sense of self or of conceiving meeting experience. A reflection, my own reflection on this. Again, the first two, flipping it around is how I made this reflection. So this is mine. Yep, that one's familiar. That feeling of conceiving, yep, that one I know. This is who I am. That one's pretty familiar too. You know, I am the doer. I am the one who is the agent. I am the actor. That's kind of my sense when I hear that phrase, this I am. That's my sense of it. I am either side, kind of an equating of I am the body, or I am the one who engages, who does. So just that kind of a sense of I am the subject of the sentence. You know, everything revolves around the subject of the sentence. I am the subject of the sentence. And the third one, this is myself, or this is me. That one, and again, it's not described this way in the commentaries as far as I know, but it was useful. This was a very useful reflection for me, because there was an experience at some point, an actual experience of recognizing the uncontrollability of the aggregates, that I was not doing them. I was not in charge of seeing. I was not in charge of knowing. That was pretty clear. But the experience felt like it was happening to me. So a subtler form of conceiving. I went and reported this to Gil. This was on a retreat with Gil, and I went and reported this to Gil. I can't see through that. It feels like it's happening to me. How do I see through that? I said. And he just laughed, and he said, just notice that that's what you're experiencing. Of course. You know, I was like, oh, the sense of me. That's what's happening right now. The sense of this is happening to me. That the kind of the hapless, like, receiver of experience, just the hapless, like, wow, no control. The clinging to that, or the kind of the conceiving of that, when there's a relationship to that, can create suffering. Boy, sure, the feeling of uncontrollability when it's happening to me, that's a pretty unpleasant experience. The feeling of uncontrollability when there's no me experiencing it, not a problem. Just uncontrollability happening. So I'll end with a reflection around conceiving. A couple of places, maybe just the one place in the Majjhima 140, it talks about the tides of conceiving. And that's an interesting image. To me, it feels more like the tsunamis of conceiving. these like massive waves, not the gentle tide coming in and going out. It's like, yeah, the tsunamis of conceiving. And the sentence is, when the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over one, one is called a sage at peace. Then this translation, again, Jnanananda's translation, he's using in this section, for some reason he switched his translation of the word usually translated as conceiving to imagining. And that creates a little bit of a different flavor. So I like playing with the different translations and seeing how do they land, you know, what do they evoke with a different kind of flavor. So, you know, even going back to the translation that Jnanananda made around the Kalakarama Sutta, one does not imagine a visible thing apart from sight, does not imagine an unseen, does not imagine a thing worth seeing, does not imagine a seer. It evokes that sense of the mind making things up. So it has a kind of a lively resonance in at least in this mind. And so there is this passage he translates using imaginings. The tides of imagining. I am is an imagining. This I am is an imagining. I shall be is an imagining. I shall not be is an imagining. I shall be one with form is an imagining. I shall be formless is an imagining. I shall perceive, I shall be percipient is an imagining. I shall be non-percipient is an imagining. I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient is an imagining. Imagining is an illness. It's a barb. It's an abscess. This will sound a little familiar. It goes on, therefore, you should train yourselves. We shall dwell with a mind free from imaginings. Thus you should train yourself. So a different way in to that Bahia Sutta, train yourself, and the seen is only the seen. Train yourself with a mind free from imaginings. Now, imaginings are going to be arising, and so we can't stop them. So train yourself to notice imaginings are happening. Boy, imaginings happen all the time. And again, to restate the possibility of freedom here, by overcoming all conceiving, by overcoming all imaginings, one is called a sage at peace. The sage at peace is not shaken and does not yearn. That description of freedom, again, being the absence of mind shaking, reaching, yearning, the absence of that. What might that be? The Buddha says it is peace. As a positive word, instead of the absence of. Peace as the absence of greed, aversion, delusion, the absence of imaginings, the absence of shaking, the absence of yearning. And our practice is to just be with experience. Seeing the imagining, seeing the yearnings, seeing the longings. Seeing the longings, actually pretty profound. That longing, this came up in a group the other day, the feeling of longing for can be longing for something in the world, but also the longing for freedom. The longing for belonging. The longing to be loved. That longing, it's a flavor, in a way, a flavor of experience that feels kind of, I talked the other day about how any kind of suffering, you know, there's the pointing back to truth, impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable, and also pointing back to the wish, the metta wish, compassion wish for freedom, for happiness, for ease, for freedom from suffering, a wholesome wish. Longing is just a hair's breadth difference from those wholesome wishes. It's a little bit of clinging in there, but it's close. And so the being with the longing, in my own experience, when I got back, you know, kind of saw a whole chain of stuff like anger, frustration, fear, and then under it's like, whoa, the longing, the wanting to be loved, the fear of not being accepted, not belonging, and just watching it, just being with that longing, that wish. There's a kind of a dropping into the place or the space of seeing there wasn't anything to be afraid of, nothing to do. And the place that the mind opened to there was just the metta. And so I talked yesterday about how when the mind lets go of craving, of what's in the way, of the conceiving, the Brahma-Viharas can be right there. And that was my experience in that moment. The mind, kind of the thought that arose in the mind is, what is there to be afraid of here? Is there to be afraid, this non-belonging idea, what is there to actually be afraid of here? And the mind just dropped into this place of well-wishing, of metta. And the powerful, this was a moment that changed my life. You know, a few moments in my practice where it's really I can point to, it's like, wow, that was a moment where everything shifted. And this was one of those moments where there was a recognition of the feeling of that metta. That feeling, which was just available, didn't need anything or anyone to be experienced. It didn't need to bounce off of a person. It didn't need a thing. Metta doesn't need a thing. Great connection to this teaching of not conceiving of a thing worth seeing, or not conceiving of a thing. Metta doesn't need things. In fact, I think metta is purer in a way without things. The experience in that moment with that metta that didn't need a thing the recognition was, this is what the longing was looking for. The longing thought it needed it to come from outside. But that was such a powerful understanding of that the very movement out was preventing the understanding or the seeing of what was already or what's available without needing someone else or something else. Quite a powerful recognition, and the practice was very much that opening to the yearning. And so all of these words, you know, the Tathagata does not yearn, the Tathagata does not conceive, we can't just flip our minds to that space, but we can be curious about the conceiving, the yearning, not with any idea that it's a problem. In fact, the very meeting of it is what takes us to freedom. Freedom is available through the meeting. That is what Sayadaw points us to do with the practice. And to as the momentum builds, to just be with the practice, to just rest and let awareness and wisdom do their jobs. Seeing the yearning, occasionally maybe tasting the freedom from yearning. So that little part at the end was a little surprise. Didn't know that one was coming. And it took us past time, so I apologize for that. But such delight in your engagement, such appreciation for your practice. May the beneficial energies of the practice of all of us combined come together and be offered to support the well-being of the entire world, of all beings everywhere.